Hello and welcome to this Clinic Oncology podcast extra. Today we're joined by Rob Shooter, Natalia Kurek, Joey Lowe and Balasangira to discuss the climate crisis, sustainability and how these relate to the NHS. We were prompted to make the podcast following an editorial recently published in the journal by Rob and Joey about this topic. So thank you all for joining us today. Could we start by each of us introducing ourselves? My name's Vince Levin. I'm a clinical oncology registrar in Leeds Cancer Centre and a junior assistant editor for the Clinical Oncology Journal.
Yeah, I'm Rob Tutor, principal clinical scientist in radiotherapy at the Christie and also the chair of the Environment Sustainability Committee in IPEM.
Hi, I'm Natalia Kurek. I'm the senior clinical lead for the Greener NHS programme at NHS England and Improvement and formerly a surgical trainee.
Hi, I'm Joey Lowe. I'm a clinical scientist working mainly in radiotherapy, but also with some responsibilities in PET imaging at Mount Vernon Cancer Centre at Mount Vernon Hospital.
Hi, I'm Balasangira. I'm a clinical scientist at the Paul Strickland Scanner Centre at Mount Vernon Hospital, work with Jerry, and I work predominantly in PET CT.
Thank you very much. I thought I'd start, Rob and Jerry, if you could tell us what motivated you to write the editorial for Clinic Oncology and perhaps summarise for our listeners what you said during the editorial and tell us about the impact that you hope that it will have.
So I think for me, it was kind of, I feel like personally, I've done about as much as I can with kind of limiting my kind of climate impact. So it was about time to start thinking about it in the workplace instead. And kind of writing something for Clinic Oncology seemed to kind of very good start to do that. And it was generally to kind of raise awareness of the kind of climate emergency, highlight that climate change and healthcare are completely interlinked. So, you know, kind of climate change causes kind of health problems, then people go to hospital. But having treatment in hospitals also has a carbon footprint. It was to highlight that. And generally, I wanted it to be like a call to action. Like, this is the problem. What are you going to do about it? So I wrote it in quite a kind of deliberately slightly aggressive style, but hopefully it wasn't too bad. Also wanted to highlight what the kind of IPEM group had been doing and kind of generally try and kind of expand that to more physicists and kind of outside of physics as well.
Yeah, I'd echo everything Rob's just said. It's an absolute no-brainer that if we are interested in health, we need to consider the climate and wider sustainability issues. It's just you can't get away from that. But I think we do ignore that. And there's still a huge way to go in terms of raising awareness within the NHS community. There's still, when you survey different departments, you get the same result from down the country, so far as I'm aware. Everybody knows there's a problem. Everybody wants something to be done about it. Nobody's got any headspace to think about what to do about it. And we've got to get past this because, you know, whether we like it or not, we just have to. And it's you get people feel powerless. People feel, what can we do? What can I do in my role? But when we all work together, then we can achieve something. So I think that's one of the key things about getting the issue out there to be discussed and to be discussed at this time when we're recovering from COVID. And just the fact that it's, we want to put it that it's not, again, sometimes held to be the opposite of clinical efficacy. And it's not, it's the same thing. It's that you can't, it doesn't stand in the way of clinical progress. It goes with it. And that's going to become more so as time goes on. So those things really I was wanting to put across.
Yeah, some really important messages. And I think we'll cover some of that in more detail later in the podcast. Bal and Natalia, if I could turn to you. So many people, as Rob and Jerry have highlighted, will be aware of the impact in their own lifestyles. So, you know, what we eat, how we travel, how we use energy, and so on, and how that contributes to the climate crisis. But workplace, as Rob said, is perhaps something that people don't necessarily think immediately of. But are you able to highlight some of the impact that workplaces have in terms of impact on the climate? Natalia, perhaps a view of the NHS as a whole through your role, and Bao, perhaps a focus on radiology and radiotherapy services, if possible.
Thanks, Finn, and happy to kick one off. So yes, as kind of highlighted in the editorial, the NHS is responsible for 4 to 5% of the UK's carbon footprint, which is roughly equivalent to a country the size of Denmark. So with 1.4 million staff, we really are both part of the solution as well as being part of the problem. And I think we really have to embrace that being part of the solution. And so what the NHS did in 2020 was it mapped its carbon footprint. And what that really did was identify some of the sources where there are the highest sources of emissions. So we looked at areas such as building energy, water and waste, medicines, specifically kind of anaesthetic gases and metered dose inhalers, business travel, the NHS fleet itself. And then more broadly, those areas that we can influence, not the areas we necessarily have direct control over, but areas that we can influence. So that's medicines and chemicals, kind of broader medical equipment, non-medical equipment, and then the huge encompassing the rest of the supply chain. What does that mean? So those are kind of the broad areas that we've identified as being sources of carbon, our kind of higher sources of carbon emissions. But there's still a lot of work to be done, specifically from the clinical perspective, because clearly you can reduce all of those sources of emissions if you make clinical services more efficient and you start focusing on the preventative side of healthcare rather than treating patients in acute settings.
Some really important messages there. Thank you, Natalia. Well, if we can move on to you, are you able to highlight perhaps some of the impacts in relation to radiology and radiotherapy services specifically?
As a sort of a PET physicist, I'll talk more about the radiology side of it. I'm sure Jerry can talk about the radiotherapy. I'm sure many of you are aware that the diagnostics is really important for any kind of treatment. And of course, that sort of diagnosis requires a lot of equipment and a lot of personnel and a lot of consumables. So there's an awful lot of plastic waste, cardboard waste, paper waste, drug waste, you know, the whole sort of gamut. Plus, we also have people prior to COVID who would be working in the office a lot. So we'd have a lot of aircon on constantly, lighting, heating, workstations, people going to the restaurants to eat food, you know, the whole sort of cycle of waste and lack of efficiency. That has now, to some extent, started to, you know, it's starting to being addressed. We're having people working from home. And to be honest, if you're working from home, you tend to be a lot more savvy about your own carbon footprint in terms of waste, etc. So I think the beginnings are starting to show now that actually COVID has had a positive impact in this context. But there's still a lot of work to do. And what we're all trying to achieve here, I think, is just that sending that message out to our colleagues. How can we reduce that carbon footprint and still stay safe within the clinical environment?
Thank you, Bal. Could I also ask you about how you can make sustainability changes when you've got different organisations involved, such as, for example, partnerships between NHS and charitable organisations?
It's actually a bit of a dilemma because, just say for the sake of argument, your hospital land belongs to one trust, you're renting it and you're another, you know, another trust, all sorts of these factors come through. And then if you take my position, which is I work for an independent charity, we have that to throw into the mix. So there are lots of different organisations that work together, and sustainability can sometimes be quite challenging under that remit. So it's who takes responsibility for a particular venture, who has the liability if something goes wrong, how do we fund it, bearing in mind that hospital trusts have green plans now, which they must adhere to. It's a mandatory requirement at trust level, at board level. But of course, charities don't have those resources. So we'd like to do quite a lot. So it's how to marry all these different sort of chiefs who want to, you know, have sort of different outcomes at the end of the day, and how we do that successfully. I think we are doing it, but you have to be aware of that. And I've had three or four projects which have basically dealt with land from one of the trusts, and they said you can't do that because you've got to ensure that this is, you know, in place, this is in place, this is in place, and there's a whole hurdle, you know, I wouldn't say hurdle, but, you know, regulatory requirement. So just be aware of who owns what and how you work with all your colleagues and partners. It doesn't mean it doesn't have to, you know, take place. It just means there's a lot of logistics to deal with if you're coming in from an outside organization. It's easy if you're in the NHS trust, but if you're from outside, it can sometimes cause hurdles. But we all strive to work together.
Can I just pick up on a point that Bal made, which is obliquely, that in medicine, we're all so used to being specialists. So you're a specialist oncologist or a PET radiologist. You're not a general surgeon anymore. And obviously that comes with great clinical benefits. But in this sense, in sustainability terms, we've all got to be generalists. And we're perhaps used to saying sustainability, that's somebody else's job. But there's someone in the hospital administration who'll look after that. And actually, that isn't true, that it's something that each of us needs to, because each of us is contributing, each of us needs to keep awareness of. And there's, a little bit of a culture change we need in that sense, that it's we can't just ship this off to a sustainability professional and pretend someone else has dealt with it.
I give sustainability talks at work, and quite often the the way it's addressed is, what are you going to do about the world problem, the global problem? And I normally always turn it back and say, well, you know, we're all dealing with it. A large number of us have children who will then inherit the problems that we, you know, produce now. It is difficult because we all have problems with, you know, line managers, with time at work, with COVID and everything else. But it's something that we're starting to become familiar with and understand the necessity for.
I think also, like, kind of, the more we can be aware of kind of how this is going to affect our children, the more you can make it kind of an emotional connection to climate change. Because a lot of the time at the moment, it's just seen as like a scientific problem, but it's absolutely not a scientific problem. It's a kind of an emotional problem. It's kind of the problem for our children. And more you can kind of make that emotional connection, more people are going to actually act on it.
Yeah, I have a 20-year-old daughter doing physics. And every time we discuss sort of green issues, you know, quite often she'll go very quiet. And I think it's, you know, when you've got your own sort of enclosed world and you're thinking about studies, etc., it can be a little bit challenging to focus on larger issues. But what I say to my family is, at some point, especially the children, you will have your own children, then it become much more, you know, of something that will become passionate within you. So it's just a matter of time to try and win hearts and minds, I think. Yeah, I agree.
And then in terms of global justice, of course, there are parts of the world where it's not the children, it's this generation that's really suffering. Yeah. So there is that whole global justice issue as well.
I think there's some really important messages there, and particularly that it's everyone's responsibility. It's not somebody else's. That's certainly a key thing to take forward. Natalia, could you tell us about your work as part of the Greener NHS programme?
Yes, I'm very happy to. So the Greener NHS programme is a huge programme now, really, that it's really kind of accelerated in its growth over the last 18 months since we made our net zero targets, which is really exciting. And we're seeing exactly what all of you have kind of mentioned today, is, you know, that advocacy across the system. There is that engagement across clinicians, across the system, across estates and facilities manager, procurement managers across the system. And the programme itself is split into those areas that we know what the interventions are, our estates, how we can make buildings more efficient, how we can transition our fleet into electric vehicles, how we can encourage people to cycle to work, support the infrastructure around that. Again, medicines, I mentioned the two before, the most polluting medicines that we know of at the moment, so our inhalers and our anaesthetic gases as well. But there is a huge amount of unknown, and there is a lot of work that still needs to be done. And those areas of unknown almost sit under me, and I'm tasked with the challenge of looking at them. So one of those is the workforce. So you've all addressed this already, but how do we galvanize 1.4 million people to take action? It's taking action as an individual. It's taking action as part of a team. It's taking action as a leader. It's challenging your leaders to take action too. And that's really what we're trying to do. And working with different clinical professional groups within the organization, working with our chief allied health professional officer, and really trying to think through what motivates specific professional groups, what action can they take, where do they see the greatest action that they can take, and how can they translate that into some of the conversations that they're having with patients? Because what we really need to do is take patients on this journey with us too. We can't be doing this in silo to our patients. We're seeing patients ask us, is this a carbon friendly kind of pathway procedure? Is there a more environmentally sustainable option? And that's fantastic to see that engagement, but we need to respond to that and develop a mechanism to have those engaging conversations. So that's one of the really exciting areas of work that I'm doing within the Greener NHS programme. And also thinking about leadership. So we spoke about green plans, and part of the work with green plans is also identifying ICS and trust board leads for net zero. And I think that's what's really important, is having someone who is accountable, who is visible at that senior level, who is talking and advocating for net zero and reminding everybody that it is a priority for the organization. It is a challenge. There will be many bumps along the way. We do not know all the solutions, but having that figurehead is critical. And how do we support those leaders, those future leaders. And that's also what we're looking at. So looking at developing training specifically around carbon literacy, specifically around what it means to be a net zero leader within healthcare. We don't really know that. We're the first healthcare system in the world to commit to getting to net zero. We can't necessarily look at too many examples for internationally. And so we're really trying to think that through and, you know, what we can do, how we can support future net zero leaders. And one of the ways of doing that, which is quite exciting, is we have our new kind of Chief Sustainability Officer's Clinical Fellowship Scheme, a massive mouthful there. But, you know, getting trainees who are keen, who are interested, who have demonstrated that they have worked on sustainability projects and bringing them into NHS England and improvement, bringing them into arm's length bodies as advocates, as drivers, as passionate clinicians to support the work that we're doing and hopefully training them as the next generation of leaders. So that's one of the areas of work. There are many others, and I'm not sure we have time to cover them off, but one that I really do want to touch on is research and innovation as well. So I mentioned that we do not know all the answers, and I think that is very, very clear and apparent to everybody who's working on this agenda. So it's how do we generate that evidence to support the change, especially on the clinical side of things, because that's where the biggest challenge is. And so how can we work together? How can we work with research councils, whether it's the NIHR, MRC, who have calls open at the moment, specifically looking at that question? How can we identify more environmentally sustainable clinical practices or clinical trials? I'm really excited to see some of the proposals that come out through that. So I think that'd be really exciting. But also innovation. We need to stimulate the market. We've seen it within other sectors, but we haven't necessarily seen it within health. So how can we start talking to innovators across cancer programs, cardiology programs, respiratory programs? All innovations need to start taking into consideration net zero. How does your innovation demonstrate that in the long term it will save carbon as well, clearly, as ensuring that we maintain and delivering high quality care for patients, which is fundamentally the most important part that we all play.
That's great. Thank you very much, Sally. It was really interesting to hear about the work you've been doing. And there's obviously some really practical aspects and practical suggestions there. It's already been mentioned the challenge that the pandemic and the recovery from that potentially has in sort of balancing that alongside sustainability and prioritising the climate crisis. I wondered if we might be able to kind of talk about those challenges and how we might be able to perhaps balance the two things.
I was just going to say it's completely aligned to what Bal said earlier, which is that the net zero, the sustainability agenda is not a competing agenda. It is completely aligned with COVID recovery. It is completely aligned with the long-term plan priorities. It is completely aligned with getting it right, first-time principles to reduce variation, improve productivity. If we deliver more efficient, you know, safer care, earlier diagnosis, earlier treatment, focus on prevention, all of those areas align with saving carbon in the long term. And so that's really what we need in this recovery process is almost just changing that narrative, shifting that narrative when we talk to people. Because I think it's about getting everyone on side. We're not asking people to do anything different. We're just asking them to really consider sustainability in the actions that they are taking to improve the way that they deliver care to patients. And I think that's really important.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think we need to bear in mind that, I mean, it's very hard to work out exactly what climate change is going to look like. But if you take anything but the very, very most optimistic, in fact, even if you take the optimistic end, it's probably worse than COVID. So if we've worried about COVID for the last 2 years, we just need to be mindful of the fact that if you put the numbers into the modelling that on the papers I've seen anyway, the chances are climate change is going to have a much more bad effect than COVID. But Natalia, you're right, it's a change of mindset, because as we come out of COVID, rightly, we've been so concerned with infection prevention and control over the last couple of years. Absolutely, that's what we should have been. But it's not the only thing, and we now need to consider all these other things, and sustainability is chief amongst them, in that we need to move away. How to put this? It's not that we need to compromise our IPC at all, but we need to consider what we're doing, what consumables we're using, what needs to be single use, what doesn't need to be single use, what how we can reduce and become sustainable in our use of stuff without compromising IPC. And in a sense, as we recover from COVID, that's a little bit of a shift of mindset onto a more balanced approach, really, rather than a one horse type race that we've been running in the last 2 years.
I would completely agree with that. And we're seeing that discussion, that conversation with nursing colleagues who are starting to question, you know, the way that they are using gloves or the way that they are using PPE. Because as you say, there has been, just before the pandemic started in January 2020, there was this amazing Gloves Off campaign, had, you know, thousands of nurses really engaged, really talking about, you know, how we should be more mindful about the way that we use plastics within the NHS. And I think we are starting to be in a place where we can start having those conversations again. And I think it's really important to start engaging with different professional groups to see where, you know, to do a temperature check almost and see where they are and work with them to start moving on this agenda together, because we can't be seen pushing it from a sustainability or net zero perspective. We really need it to be part of a much broader discussion around IPC, around high quality care, around reduction of waste.
The other point I might make is just the use of our green spaces, and some hospitals are in the middle of a city, some are not. I mean, at Mount Vernon, we are very lucky to have green spaces, and there's that demonstrated link between well-being and green spaces, both in terms of staff and patients and anyone else on the site. And again, that's something that overlaps greatly with the sustainability agenda, which we really need to make good use of now going forwards.
I think to a certain extent also, like COVID, in some senses, has helped us kind of reduce our carbon footprint, because online meetings are kind of now, you know, everyone does it. People are kind of more aware of cycling, people are more aware of kind of the importance of green space. Also, everyone noticed at the beginning when kind of everything locked down how clear the atmosphere was, because there weren't so many cars on the road. So there's kind of, in quite a lot of cases, the actions we've taken because of COVID have also improved our carbon footprint kind of going forwards. A bit like kind of in radiotherapy, we're kind of, there's been this general move to hyperfractionation, so the kind of patients have to travel to the hospital less, and the kind of machine is on less, and that has also been kind of, so there's a kind of positive side to it too, and it all links together, of course.
But I think crucially what we need to, I totally agree, Rob, but what we need to avoid taking a step backwards and saying, oh, we can meet face to face. And I know there are organizations who are saying, that's great, we can forget about COVID now, meet face to face, which is not true sustainability wise, it's also not true COVID wise.
You can also say that, you know, kind of people had kind of good holidays in the UK for like a year or two. Now there's that worry that everyone's going to forget that and then jump on a plane again. But we'll see.
I think what I'm finding from my experience is that a lot of people are still in shock from the COVID stress on a daily basis. And there are times when I feel like sort of shouting the green message, and you know full well that it's just not appropriate, you know, from my perspective. So I end up doing a bit more than I would normally do, but at the same time, it's better to keep people on board than to lose them. And traditionally, with, you know, same with COVID, there are people who believe it's there, people who don't believe. The same with green issues, there are people who believe it's important, people who don't. So I'm sort of just being sensitive to the issues that are going on with people at the moment, and hopefully that won't, you know, go on forever. It'll be a very small, time limited sort of issue, but people are aware of the green aspects of what they need to be doing. It's just, I think there's a lot of stress in the system right now, and unless one gets support, the full support of one's line managers and the people higher up in the food chain, it can be difficult to spread the message. But it's really important that we do in very small, subtle little, you know, bite-sized chunks, so people can digest it without feeling threatened. That's just my perspective.
Yeah, I completely agree. There's kind of been, the kind of departments are already quite strained because of COVID. So then saying on top of it, oh, we also need to think about kind of the climate, can make you seem almost a little bit insensitive. So it can be a problem.
I thought, Rob, Jeremy and Bala, I might ask you to tell us a bit about the work that IPEM is doing through the Environmental Sustainability Group. And also, what contribution do you think the Royal College of Radiologists and Society of Radiographers potentially could make?
So we started the kind of the group just before COVID hit. So we started it in February 2020. And it was kind of created to allow people to have a network, because doing some of this stuff can feel quite lonely. Because you quite regularly feel like you're one of the only people kind of really worrying about it. But this group has kind of shown that you're not the only people worrying about it. There's a lot of people out there. And it also is very helpful because when you're thinking about it kind of daily, it can worry you. But then when you kind of meet as a group, it can kind of, you can, you kind of, people share their enthusiasm and ideas with it as well. It can make you, kind of make you feel much more positive. And there's kind of lots of things we've done so far, including kind of writing to manufacturers to get them to think about their packaging and the transport of their kind of radiopharmaceuticals. We've kind of done some kind of carbon footprinting projects, one in the radiotherapy that has been funded by Greener NHS. And I've kind of been writing quite a lot of newsletters for various different things, including one for Esther about the impact of conferences and can we do conferences differently? You know, can you do it? You know, there's face-to-face, there's online, there's hybrid. Could you just have it every other year? Because a lot of the times there's the same thing said both years. Or could you alternate between online for 2 years and then offline for kind of face-to-face for the third year? So there's, yeah, so that's what we've discussed so far.
I think what thing I would like to, if I had an ask of the College of Radiographers in answer to the second part of your, it would be at this time raising awareness, because there is still that. So for example, I gave a recorded talk on sustainability to a staff group in my hospital a few weeks ago, and I have no evidence that anything's changed as a result of it. Now, okay, my talk could have been awful, but I don't think it's that bad. And I think that it's just that it's not yet on the agenda of lots of staff. Now, I think if you look top down in the NHS, there's lots of really good stuff coming from NHS, from Greener NHS, the green plans at the management level. And there's also a lot of enthusiasm at the bottom. There's a lot of individuals who really get it and get that we're going to have to engage with this. But in the middle, where you've got busy professionals who are already stretched, we've had this conversation already, there's got to be some adaptation. There's got to be some headspace given to green issues. And it's getting that in place that I think is a key ask. And these are clinical individuals. These are not sustainability board members or something like that. It's busy clinical individuals. So one thing I think the college could really do would be to raise the awareness in that group, which of the radiographer community, that would establish sustainability as a key issue.
So I'd also like to say that kind of like people generally really trust clinicians, and they spend a lot of time with the radiographers kind of being treated, and they kind of care for them and look after them and talk to them a lot. So if they could also kind of promote kind of green messages, then people would listen. So that's another reason why it's important to have them on board. Sorry, Belle.
Sorry, I was just thinking, I used to be a medical physics examiner with the Royal College of Radiologists, so I kind of know how their infrastructure works in terms of, I used to be sort of involved with setting physics exams, say all the clinicians. And one of the things was that there was a lead time for the sake of argument, just say you wanted to incorporate some green issues into some syllabus or curriculum sort of issues, just generally, and then for there to be an exam or something of that nature is one thing, but just a general sort of discourse about green is another thing. But to incorporate things into syllabus tends to take sort of 18 months or so, because, you know, you've got the whole exam process. But there's no reason why the Royal College of Radiologists can't actually just send the message out at a high level, particularly with the heads of departments who tend to be sort of, you know, clinical people. That would help an awful lot, actually. Just to disseminate the message from the approved bodies, not just the Royal College of Radiologists, but others, including the Society of Radiographers, etc. There is a lot of good work that could be done, I think, once those established bodies become involved formally.
So one thing with the curriculum, we tried to get it on the curriculum for medical physics for like universities and stuff like that, and that seemed like a bit of a no-go in the end. So what I did in the end is just emailed the people that kind of organize the lectures and say, can I do a lecture? And of course they said yes, because it's kind of a free lecture about something a bit different. So there's always ways around everything, and we'll still, when the kind of the next call for like changing the curriculum comes up, we'll definitely put something in. But because this is an emergency, we need to do something now, you know, that's one way of doing it.
And I think there's also something about bringing all the colleges together and all of the societies together, and, you know, learning from each other, you know, where are the carbon hotspots within, you know, your area of clinical practice? Because I think, as I said at the beginning, there is still a lot of there's a lack of evidence across all of these clinical pathways. So there's a huge wealth from shared learning, from best identifying best practice across all of the various professions, and not just working in silo too.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a kind of a multidisciplinary profession, and we need to kind of think about climate change exactly that same way as well.
And there's so many common core themes here that we can all benefit from, you know,
precisely.
Over time.
Thank you very much. I thought finally, I might ask each of you what key take-home messages you might have, and particularly what practical steps each of us could take in order to make a difference.
So I think my main one would be to join a group, because that then makes you feel less alone and less daunting. Do as much as you can, but don't do any more, because it can start feeling overwhelming. And like everything that's big has changed in society has always started with something small. So don't feel like just because you're doing something small, it's not going to change anything. Cycle. Coronavirus has made me start cycling, and it's been great. It's been amazing. We've now got an e-cargo bike to carry my kids as well. We're one of those people. There's an excellent book called How Bad Are Bananas, written by Mike Berners-Lee. And that is one of those books that you read it and it will change how you think about everything, because it's literally the carbon footprint of everything. He goes through, and it sounds dull, but it's actually very well written. And it kind of just makes you start looking at everything as if it's got a carbon footprint next to it. And that really helps to change your kind of mindset. And just talk about climate change with people, with anyone, with everyone, with your family, your friends, because the more it can get it into people's heads as like a normal conversation you talk about, the more likely it is that kind of it will become a big thing that politicians have to do something about.
I mean, I think that's brilliant, Rob. Really good points there. One thing I'd like to say is
I cheated by going first. Sorry.
by way of take a message that it is all of us, and I think there's this misconception that it is somebody else's problem. So I was talking to one of my niece's colleagues recently, and he was poised with the desflurane to anaesthetize someone, and his point was, well, why should I change, because there's much more coming out of all the aircraft up there. What's the issue? And that's just not the way to look. I've heard that before, and I think that's a common misconception. That's not the way to look at it, because it's the same thing. People say the NHS is 5% of UK carbon emissions. Well, 5% is not a very big figure, but actually there isn't any one big emitter elsewhere out there that needs to change. I think that a point is that, you know, the NHS is about just over 5% of UK GDP as well. So it kind of is across the board. The emission is across the board throughout industry. And there are little ups and downs, but by and large, all of us, everything we do is an emitter. And if we make a 10% reduction personally, and everyone does that, then that is a 10% reduction across the UK, and even more so globally. And there's no other way. You really can't put this onto other people. It's all of us. And so it really is starting the conversation in your department. We are trying to set up at Mount Vernon green ambassadors or green champions or whatever you call them, just people who are leading the conversation and facilitating really how to change practice in a busy department in a way that's going to become more sustainable. And I think that's a key point. So yeah, it's doing the little things, being aware of it each day. It's we're generalists. We need to just be aware every day, and whatever we do, just, is this the best way to do it? Is there a more sustainable, can I do without some travel? Am I requesting something that's going to result in a journey of a vehicle? How many consumables do I really need to use for this? And nothing's negligible, because it's all there. And there's another point as well, because I've been asked a couple of times now, why am I worried about people leaving lights on when there's a Linac in the room? And again, this is the point that we need to cut down on our waste, because we need the Linac to treat patients. No one is saying turn your Linac off. You're only allowed 100 monitor units per patient. No one is saying that. Our clinical efficacy must still be there. But in the NHS, there's a lot of waste. You walk from one side to the other of a department and you will spot things that are wasteful that can be changed for the better. So it's a matter of changing what we can to reduce, to get rid of the waste and keep what we need in order to treat our patients. I think that's a key thing.
I would agree with all of the points that have just been said. I'm not sure there's much more for me really to add. I apart from maybe something around, you know, education and training, there is always something more that you can learn or some training that you can guide someone towards. You know, encourage everybody that you talk to within the clinical workplace. You know, have you done this 30-minute module on e-learning for health that is free on climate change and health? That could be their moment. That could be them understanding it and finally, you know, wanting to take action themselves. Again, exactly as what's been said, you know, speak to everybody about it, everyone and within, you know, your personal environment, but also at work. It's not just your team, it's not just your managers, it's patients, it's everybody. So really do kind of get that conversation starting. And also don't ever think that any evidence generation that you can do in your team is too small. Any ideas that you may have within your team are too small. We are very much at the beginning of this journey. So think innovatively, you know, work with your teams, think of creative ideas and solutions, because, you know, some of those solutions may be totally transformative in the coming years and supporting us in delivering net zero healthcare.
I think I view this very much from a hands-on perspective. So, and I am also aware there has been, I wouldn't say criticism, but there's been an observation that a lot of the people involved with Green Matters tend to be middle class, come from a certain background, and it's, you know, you know what I'm saying. Okay, so my perspective on this was back in 2002, I used to fill my car with twice a week with cardboard and plastics from our scanner centre, take it to our local dump, recycle centre, and deposit it there. And then after about 3 months, they said, sorry, you can't do that anymore. It's obviously commercial waste. So I went to my local one at home, did the same thing. They banned me there after a while as well. But the point I'm making is that unless we each do something, nothing will get done. Yeah. So do what you can do. What I do now is I do an audit at the end of every day. It takes me literally 5 minutes, easy. I look at whether the bins have the right things in them. I'm stupid enough still to put things from one bin into another as safely as I can do. I check that the lights are off. I check that the water's off. I check the aircon's off. It literally takes me 5 minutes. And then I have a little spreadsheet, a little graph. It's like a pie chart, and it shows how well compliant we are. And what I've also done is stipulate when we're not being compliant. So that's the evidence. And everybody can do that, whether you're an intellectual genius, you've got a PhD, or you're a professor of a head of department, or whether you work in an office. So that's the message I'm getting across to the rank and file, is we can all do something. It doesn't have to be huge and intellectual. We can do something small, tangible, and show the evidence for it. And that's capable within any department anywhere. So that's the message I'm sending home, is what can you do that's within your means and within your grasp at this point in time? It doesn't have to be huge, as Rob was saying.
There's also some like kind of, some of the climate science shows that even small changes matter. So because they're kind of, there's a lot of positive feedback loops out there, like kind of like with the polar ice caps melting, there's less white, so the albedo effect reflects less heat back into the atmosphere. So there's lots of positive feedback loops. So any small change you make gets multiplied in that sense. And also because there's like kind of a lot of these like a lot of climate tipping points, if kind of you saving that tiny little bit means we get to that tipping point later or don't get to it at all, then again your kind of effect is multiplied. So I just wanted to make that point.
It's interesting because I work in the same department as Bal, I can say that actually I've seen the change, and Bal's work actually had, we don't have hard data, but what, well, don't think you do, Bal, but you might, but just anecdotally,
he's got a spreadsheet
but
which I'm intending to publish. I've got a year, actually, at the end of this month, there'll be a year of audit from our green stuff. Sorry, carry on, Jerry.
Now, that's really good. But it does actually make a difference. The scanner centre is different as a result of that work. So what Bal said is a good approach. And I think we found this also with my colleague Vicky Newton's work in radiotherapy physics. It's exactly the same, that there are people commenting about the quality of the waste segregation, and that is because of Vicky's work. So it does make a difference.
I think it's communication as well, as and personal connections you have with people. So I know our cleaners really well. I mean, really, really well. So we sort of have this common sort of, you know, chit chat about, you know, recycling, etc. And I think for us, really, the key is, as ambassadors or green champions, whatever you want to call it, is to get that message to colleagues who we can talk to. So, you know, the message becomes understood. We're not seen as alien or sort of, you know, a different class of person. We're exactly the same as everybody else. And once you've got tie in, it's beautiful. Everybody wants to then join in. It's fantastic.
That's fantastic. I'd like to thank you all for taking part. It's been a really enjoyable discussion. And I think you've provided some really practical steps that we can all take to try and make a difference in terms of the climate crisis. Thank you for listening to this Clinical Oncology Podcast Extra. We hope you've enjoyed the podcast, and you can find more podcasts like this one on the Clinical Oncology website.